Herbert Blomstedt, thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me and for coming to Boston to conduct Mozart and to give us an opportunity to broadcast your performance of Mozart. Can you tell me what your earliest experience of Mozart was?
I think it must have. I was a violinist as a boy, but my mother wanted me to have a little bit piano too. So what I could play by Mozart was a sonata facile, and so on, only white keys. But I could play only the first bars, of course. I was just a kid. But that was perhaps my first acquaintance with Mozart. I did have another experience with Mozart that was quite remarkable. And that was when I listened to the radio on the summer vacation. I was up with my grandparents, farmers far up to the northwest of Sweden. And they had a little radio. This was in the 1930s, mid-1930s. A very primitive radio for our taste today. But we could hear also foreign countries, and we listened to a radio station in Germany, because on every Sunday at 11 o'clock there was a concert on that little radio, and I heard my later orchestra, the Dresden Staatskapelle, play. And so on. The A major theme from one of the piano sonata with variations, written for orchestra by Max Reger, with lots of wonderful variation and a giant fugue at the end. The sound was absolutely captivating. It was like sorcery to me, another world. And that was Mozart. I had played a little bit of that also on the piano, just the first few bars I could play on the piano. And when I heard it from the orchestra, that charmed me forever. Then later, of course, when we played the string quartet at home, we played Mozart's quartets. After we had been done with all 76 of Haydn, they were a little bit simpler for young students. And Mozart was then a revelation. And I remember when we played a dissonance quartet, which is a C major, that made a special impression because it was so weird harmonies, really weird dissonances. That fascinated me at that time also. And that is really the background of this program also. When we put together a program of three Mozart symphonies, usually you hear the three last ones then, the E-flat and the G minor and the Jupiter. But I would like to do something different. I think the others were not possible for their program planning here. So I decided to, why not do a program of three C major symphonies? That is, the first one is really a minor symphony for time, but it's in C major. But also then, you know, this was back in Salzburg. I think it was the last symphony he wrote in Salzburg.
This is the 34th you're talking about. And in what sense is it minor?
Well, it's short. It's only 23 minutes.
I see, minor in the sense, I see, yes.
It has only three movements. It has no menuetto. But it's great music, of course, great music. And he doesn't go on for many bars until he's in the minor mode. And during this movement, also the first movement, he oscillates between major and minor in the most striking way. It's in 4-4, and the first quarter can be in minor, next bar is in major, next one is again in major, so it's as if he couldn't make up his mind. He's torn, you know, between positive and negative, simply speaking, feelings. It's almost like crying, but in a dance setting. It was very dramatic. And that he did that relatively early. This is before he went to Vienna. But already then he was wildly experimentating with keys. And of course the jump between the 34 and the 36 that we are playing next, which he wrote in Vienna for Linz, but he was already in Vienna, is enormous. Also in length, the Linz symphony is almost twice as long as this first 34. And it's very rich in harmony, very rich, extremely varied. But it's written for exactly the same orchestra. Exactly. No flute, no clarinets, just oboes and bassoons in the wind section, and of course horns and trumpets. Which is quite rare that he uses trumpets also for the slow movement. That's the first time he did that is in this, already in the 36. Yeah. In the 34th, all the winds are silent in the slow movement, which creates, of course, a completely other sound. But he knows that with a special sound, with even timp and trumpets in the slow movement, he can have some new sounds, playing very soft. It's extremely charming. And wonderful sound conception.
And then the 41, the Jupiter, is something completely different.
Of course, that is his Opus Summum, the greatest symphony he ever wrote. After that, he wrote no symphonies. And this, he lived still 3 years, but he wrote no symphonies. He wrote some other great works, some piano concertos, and of course the Requiem and so on, and wonderful chamber music. But this is his last symphony. I don't know why he did not write any more symphonies. He wrote some wonderful operas after that. And in the piano concertos, you know, his fantasy is just unbelievable, because he was a pianist. But he played practically even well the violin. His father, who was a violin teacher, a very famous one, told him often, you must play more the violin, you're as great as a violinist.
He brought him up as a prodigy violinist, didn't he?
So he, when he comes to the piano concerto, his imagination is boundless. But also in the symphonies, in the 41, you also hear that he had studied Bach, he had discovered Bach. He had heard very polyphonic music also in when he was traveling as a boy in Italy. You know, this famous story, he heard the Miserere of Allegri, which is in 18 or 20 parts, and he wrote out that from memory. It's an incredible story. So he was interested in polyphonic music. He wrote in some fugues, imitation of Bach. But in the Jupiter Symphony, the last movement, he has this fugue already after half a minute, there comes a fugue. La di ro di ro ta ti ro di ro di ro ta to ro 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 di ro ro. A very tight fugue, 5-part fugue, and of course at the end of the symphony, he adds another fugue that's even more remarkable. It's also in 5-part, but it not only uses one theme, it uses 3 themes. Fugue in 3 themes. One is the la re ra ra, which is the main theme of the movement, but he also uses the pum 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 pi ta da, pum 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 pi ta da, pum pum pum, and the second theme, tom pum pi ra 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 pum. So he put this together in the most ingenious way. We love Mozart, of course. All listeners love Mozart, and professionals perhaps love him even more. He can be so simple and moving and so complicated at the same time. But you don't notice how complicated it is. That is his trick. He knows that he has to please the listeners who are not so well into his music. He wants to please, because that gave him income. He was an independent artist, and he has to please. But he never pleases with simple music that is simplistic, you know. It's simple on the surface, but in the background it's very complicated. We always marvel at this, how that is possible. To write complicated music is not difficult. I could write that. I'm not a composer, but I could write a complicated piece, no problem. But to write a simple piece that is beautiful and meaningful is really difficult. It takes a master. And to do it at the same time, something very simple and something extremely complicated at the same time, there are very few who can do that. The more you study him, the more you understand what a master he was. He combines two ages. You know, he knew the Baroque music very well. He had a friend in Vienna, Baron van Swieten, and he was a collector, and he had many of Bach's works. All the printed works, there are not many, but there are some printed works at his time even. And then he had many manuscripts. And he showed them to Mozart. Mozart knew them and was, of course, fascinated by this composer. The immediate successors of Bach in the 1750s and 60s forgot him. They thought he was an old, belonged to another era. That was old stuff music, Whig music, you know. They wanted to be modern, more pleasing, light stuff. And Mozart was a child of that time. You can hear that perhaps especially in the slow movement of the 34, the early symphony. It's very sweet music, very very full of emotion. It's like looking at a wonderful piece of ceramics, you know, in a glass monter. It's so fragile and so beautiful, so full of feeling. You can cry here, you can feel a tear here, and you are enjoying a couple of bars here, but it's a very emotional music. That was his time. And then a little bit later comes Beethoven, the revolutionary. He uses this and expands this to something enormous, some even violent, choleric emotions. Mozart is just as deep, but under the surface of a very elegant.
Yes, and I was thinking as you were talking that Bach's sons had a big influence on Mozart. He was friends with Johann Christian Bach in London, and he must have absorbed something from the CPE Bach tradition, all that feeling, you know, that you're Empfindsamkeit or whatever it was. Yeah,
I don't know what that is. That's a good word in German. I don't know what it is in English.
I don't have any idea. That's why I said it in German. No, it's it's this feeling.
Extreme sensitivity, you know, sensitivity and emotionalism. But it's never sentimental, never cheap feelings. That's also very easy to write sentimental stuff, a sentimental song or a little ditty. Any of us can do that. And we have lots of popular music from that time that abounds in that kind. But at the same time, it must be noble. that is not so easy. That's true. He came to London as a boy, I think already as a six-year-old. And he met Christian Bach, who was living in London. That was the youngest son of Sebastian. And he was, of course, a man of the new age, completely new age. And Mozart was playing piano with him, you know, sat in his lap.
As an eight-year-old or something.
a young boy. And, of course, he admired Johann Christian Bach enormously. And Christian Bach came to London after being in Milan, and writing some wonderful operas that also, I'm sure, young Mozart knew and stimulated his fantasy for the stage. He was a great influence on Mozart.
Speaking of influences, I wanted to ask you about one of your influences, because we're celebrating the Bernstein year. And I noticed that on one bio of you, there was an indication that you had studied with Leonard Bernstein at Tanglewood. Was that an experience you have memories of that you can talk about? Any stories there?
I never forget that. That was in the summer of 53. How many years ago? That is 64 years ago. I went up, I was studying in New York at Juilliard, and went up to Bernstein. He lived on the 57th Street across the Carnegie Hall at that time. And I dared to go up and knock at his door. And I had a scholarship for 1 year, but it was ending already in June 53, and Tanglewood starts in July. And I dearly wanted to go up to Tanglewood before I return to Sweden when my scholarship is finished. So I asked him, would there be a possibility for me to study with you in Tanglewood before I go back to Sweden? And he was very sweet, which he always was. He had a special love, I think, for young musicians. So he secured a scholarship for me. I didn't have to pay any tuition. I didn't have to pay for room and board. It was the Kusevitsky Prize he gave me, which meant really not the prize for conducting, but for studying in Tanglewood. So I was there for the whole season in Tanglewood, and it was a great experience. He didn't teach very much himself. He was newly married, had a child, I think even two children at that time. And I remember going to his birthday party, not far from Tanglewood, where he lived in the summer house. I think it was the 26th of August or 27th of August, something like that, late in August. And he was, of course, most charming family man with his children and his wife. Very, very moving to see him that way. But he was very, very occupied, of course, with concerts in Tanglewood. So he didn't teach very much. We had most classes, we had Lucas Voss, which was a wonderful teacher. Lucas Voss, I think, was born in Berlin and came to America and was a wunderkind. He was a fantastic pianist, and he sat at the piano and played the scores for us and analyzed the scores with us. He didn't teach us conducting either, neither did Bernstein. It was study of scores, which was a revelation, because that's the basic of our whole profession, is to know the scores. I went to Juilliard in New York for a season, just half a year in 53, before I went to Tanglewood, and my teacher there was Jean Morel. He was a fantastic musician. He was a percussionist by profession. He played the first performance of L'Histoire du Soldat by Stravinsky, the great percussion part, as you know. That spring, he didn't teach conducting at all. We studied solfège with him that semester. I'm sure other semesters he was teaching also conducting, but this semester he taught only French solfège. This was completely new to me. I had another system of solfège from my conservatory. So this was a revelation for me. Wonderful. Lots of sight reading, lots of dictation, writing down what you heard, written a little fugue, writing down all the parts. So that was also very good training. So actually conducting training, moving my hands and in front of the orchestra was not what I got to study in America. And I don't think that Bernstein was very interested in that even. He was interested in the music and transmitting his feeling for the music and analyzing the music. And in that he was wonderful. He was a great inspiration for anybody who played with him and watched him. I'm very grateful for those experiences. I knew him until the very end of his life. When I went back to Sweden after the American experience, I had a wonderful debut concert with the Stockholm Philharmonic. And I was so successful, and I wrote to Bernstein immediately, reported, because he had told his students, please let me know how you are proceeding in your studies. It will always interest me. So I wrote him a letter. And he even answered, you know. Within a few days, he had a handwritten letter. Very full of appreciation. I'm very proud of you, and so on. And then he ended by saying, when are you coming to America? So I didn't come to America until 79. So there were many years in between. Last time I met him was in San Francisco, just a couple of months before he died. I was in San Francisco conducting my orchestra in a two-week period. I have conducted them every year for 40 years almost, because I'm still the conductor laureate of the orchestra. And it happened so that Bernstein was on tour with the Vienna Philharmonic during that time, and he came to San Francisco to play with them. I remember they played Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. He was already suffering very much, and he was very depending on alcohol and nicotine. He was suffering. When he came off stage, he immediately had to have a puff and a glass of whiskey. He was completely done, really. But he made music also in that capacity. It was incredible. He was music. He was music. The whole person. And at the same time, he was always so generous, open. You know, you could imagine that with such a history as his, you know, he would be demanding, and since he was really depending on these drugs, that he was would show that he was suffering. You know. But he was always, you know, open and generous and friendly. We sat together after the concert in the conductor's room in San Francisco and talked about all memories, and he was smoking like mad, of course, and I hate smoke, and he had this cigarette under my nose. I could not, you know, ask him to put it away, because he was my mentor. He needed it, and he even spilled some ashes on my tie, and he was so sorry, you know, tried to clean the tie. He was an absolutely wonderful person. So I'm sad he was suffering so much, but at the end he always made music.
Well, Herbert Blomstedt, thank you so much for your time today and for all this history, your long history, and what a great life you've had so far, and it continues. I'm so glad that you're conducting now.
I'm very grateful.